Georgia's DBHDD is urging people to ask a pharmacist about getting naloxone for their first aid kits at home or work. No prescription is needed. Naloxone can rapidly reverse an opioid overdose and restore breathing. Opioidresponse.info.
Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm delighted. Let me say right at the start of the show, if my audio sounds a little off to all of you out there, I apologize. We're having some significant technical problems this morning, problems we don't usually face with the great crew of engineers that we have at GPB. But we're going to get through this show, I think, in fine form. So I just wanted to, before you start tweeting, sending me emails, let you know that, again, that there are reasons why my audio doesn't sound as clean and as clear as it typically does. You know, we have been, like many of you out there, preoccupied with politics ever since really the start of this year. The runoff election took up a great deal of our time. Former President Trump's efforts to overturn the outcome of the election did as well. But now a new president is in office. Donald Trump is back in Florida. John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock are the state's two newest United States senators. And in all the time we've spent talking about the political situation in the state, we have not spent the kind of time that all of us on the Political Rewind team have wanted to do about what's happening with the virus. And so today we're going to do just that with a terrific panel of participants. Let me start, though, by setting the stage for the conversation. Our show is pretty well timed today because it was just 1 year ago yesterday that health officials in the state of Washington identified a traveler who had just come home from Wuhan, China. He sought treatment at an urgent care clinic just north of Seattle. He came in with a fever. He was feeling fatigued, and people quickly identified him as patient zero in the United States, the first confirmed coronavirus case. What's interesting about that, if you go back to January 20th and the days after it in the year 2020, is that at the time, public health officials were somewhat reassuring. They said they believed the risk to the public was still low. They cautioned that more cases were likely to come. And that, of course, is what happened. Now, nationwide, we are at 24 plus million cases and over 400,000 deaths, tragically. So that's the national stage. But before we talk more specifically about Georgia, another reason that this is an important day to be having this conversation is that on his first full day in office today, President Joe Biden is going to kickstart his coronavirus strategic plan. He's got a number of goals, including efforts to protect workers and students. He wants to create an equitable distribution of the vaccine and treatment to all Americans, minorities, as well as all others. He's going to institute a national mask mandate for federal workers, and he has said that he is going to dramatically step up distribution of the vaccine and of testing, and we're going to watch how all of that rolls out in the weeks ahead. So we'll talk a bit about both what's happening on the national stage and what's happening in the state of Georgia. Kevin Riley, the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, who is my Thursday partner on the show, is one of the people, unfortunately, who we cannot communicate right now with, but we'll hope that he is able to join us at some point fairly soon. In the meantime, we have with us Karen Landman. She is a physician, an epidemiologist, and a medical journalist. Dr. Rodney Lin, he is the interim dean of Georgia State University School of Public Health. Both of them, of course, have been frequent panelists on the show in the past, and we're glad to have them back. And we're welcoming for the first time AJC reporter Scott Truby, who's been part of the team at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which has been covering the virus here in the state. So thank you all for being with us. Scott, let me begin with you, because you filed a story this morning that gives us a pretty good look at where the virus stands right now in Georgia. Just give us some of the details of what your reporting showed.
Sure. So we got a hold of the last coronavirus task force report under the Trump administration. Data through Friday showed that we were ranked sixth in the nation for the rate of new coronavirus infections last week. We were 14th in the nation for the rate of new coronavirus deaths last week, up from 43rd a week earlier. And basically, our rolling average right now of new confirmed and suspected cases is about 7,800. That's down from the peak. We peaked, it appears, at about January 11th at about 9,800 per day. But it's still extraordinarily high, and obviously our hospitals remain taxed, and we are now seeing that wave of death that we expected from this surge in cases.
Yeah, Karen, I was the number of deaths in the state and the fact that we suddenly have had such a surge of them is obviously deeply concerning, Karen.
Yeah, it really is. It's not entirely unexpected. You know, when people congregate together, as they often do around holidays and when the weather is very cold, you know, we see more transmission. And that is certainly what we have been seeing over the last couple of weeks, but or 3 weeks, I should say. But yeah, it does seem like there is a slow in the increase, and that is a small hint of hope that we may be on the way down. I would just caution, though, that that doesn't mean that anybody should let up on any of the good social distancing measures that they're taking. You know, one of the unfortunate features of this sort of unrestrained spread that we've seen is the emergence of variants of the virus that may be more easily transmissible. And a little bit of growing concern that some of those variants might not be preventable by the vaccine. So we really need to keep on the pressure to reduce the spread of the virus. And that means continuing lots of social distancing measures, mask wearing. And, you know, I think we'll talk about this, but I'm hoping a lot of that will be facilitated by some of the initiatives in Biden's national strategy.
Yeah, we will, of course, talk about all that. Rodney, give us your initial impression of the status in Georgia right now.
Well, I mean, I would just first, you know, make the point that we're at near all-time highs for cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. And in some ways, I think, I hope this isn't so, but, you know, it's easy to become numb to these numbers. You know, we're talking about a potential decline in cases and hospitalizations, but decline from what point? I mean, we are at such a place relative to where we were 2 months ago, 6 months ago, and so on. I just want to, you know, make a point of talking about the acceleration of the pandemic so that it's clear why it's important what Karen just said in terms of wearing masks and social distancing. The first 100,000 deaths that we had in this pandemic occurred between February and May. That was May was over those 4 months, we had 100,000 deaths. The second 100,000 took another 4 months to September. The third 100,000 took 3 months to mid-December. And this fourth 100,000 has only taken 5 weeks. So, you know, this should be a real you know, cause for alarm. And it really demonstrates the exponential spread that we can have when this virus really starts to move quickly and people are gathering and so on, as happened over the holidays. So there's a lot of work to do. And, you know, the Biden administration has their hands more than full in trying to turn these numbers in the right direction.
Scott, you know, one of the things that I'm fascinated by with what Biden is proposing, and he's got a heavy lift, let's face it, in some of what he wants to do. And we'll talk about vaccines, the notion that he wants to get 100 million shots in arms in the first 100 days of his administration is an enormous goal that he's set and a challenge. But let's talk about perhaps what you would think ought to be a simpler goal. He's setting today a 100-day mask challenge, suggesting that if all Americans would just for the next 100 days and only 100 days wear masks, he believes that mitigation of the virus would be made a bit easier. And Scott, what I think is interesting about that is, of course, we're in a state that where the governor has refused to issue a mask mandate, saying that he believes that it interferes with the civil individual rights of people to choose how to deal with this pandemic, Scott.
Well, that's right. The governor has said that he believes it's the personal responsibility of all Georgians to follow the guidance that he has provided, that public health agencies have provided, and that if we all do it, we will you know, get past this virus. Unfortunately, we're not all doing it. And there has been research that has shown that states that have mask mandates have a better compliance record than states that don't. Right now, Biden last night signed an executive order to mandate masks on federal property and in some other limited circumstances. Biden probably can't do a national mask mandate, and it is up to the states to and localities to do those kinds of mandates. But the bottom line is we know masks are effective. They're not perfect, but part of an overarching personal protection strategy, social distancing, wearing a mask when you can't distance, avoiding congregate settings indoors, we know we can blunt the spread of this virus. But right now, the governor has shown no appetite to mandate anything related to masks.
You know, Rodney, and then Karen, both of you, please weigh in on this. I think at a certain point we need to stop talking about Donald Trump. He is now the ex-president. He's gone to Florida. And there's only so much more we want to talk about his administration. But in the context of where we stand with the virus right now, unfortunately, I think we do have to talk about him. And here's the context in which I was thinking about that, Rodney. Donald Trump was largely responsible, along with many of his Republican enablers, for creating a situation in which mask wearing became a partisan issue. And I can't help but wonder, and I know I'm asking you to speculate here, but I can't help but wonder if Republican governors like a Brian Kemp, like a Kristi Noem and others, if Donald Trump is no longer there making mask wearing and other precautionary measures to prevent the virus from spreading, if he's got no influence over that anymore, is there any reason to think that maybe Biden really can change the tone and that people will perhaps start thinking without this partisan lens about the virus? Am I being incredibly optimistic, Rodney, first, and then Karen?
Well, Bill, I would just say I think it's really unfortunate that masks were politicized so early and at all, frankly. We are worst in the world in, you know, really responding to and managing this pandemic. And the issue around masks is an important part of that. In many ways, I mean, we have, bans on smoking in public places in many respects because we really respect the right of the individual to not be exposed to, a product that's harmful to their health. And, you know, what you're exhaling is harmful. And I think masks are really speaking to that issue as well, that any of us could be exhaling, a viral load because we're infected and don't know it. And so it makes sense that we should have masks as something that our leaders should be promoting, and if not even requiring. So I think it's very frustrating to me as a public health person to see what's happened because it, you know, from my vantage point, it has cost lives unnecessarily, and that's really frustrating.
So Karen, I get it. I know that the statement I made was somewhat naive and overly optimistic. I get that the hardcore partisans are not about to change their tune just because a new president is in office. But there are probably people who may not choose not to wear a mask, not for political reasons, because it's an inconvenience. It feels uncomfortable. And I wonder if watching the inaugurations, for example, yesterday, in which virtually everyone was masked, is beginning to set an example that at least some people may begin to pick up on.
Yeah, you know, Bill, I think you really cannot separate doing any kind of behavior that treats the virus as a real entity from people's politics right now. And, you know, those behaviors include not just wearing a mask, but also, you know, being interested in taking a vaccine, even if you have some legitimate questions about it, and doing some other sort of social distancing thing. And we've seen, you know, since the election and the many challenges to the legitimacy of the election have played out, I think we've seen some indication that the foundations of a lot of folks, kind of really angry politics, maybe kind of starting to soften a little bit. You know, I have seen some coverage of sort of a minority of QAnon conspiracy theorists and super right-wing folk politics kind of being a little shaken and confused, and perhaps some of the rhetoric coming from folks on the left, that is against folks on the right, also softening a little bit. I think, you know, with all of this, with the inauguration now in the past, and hopefully the tone changing, my hope is that the tone of people's response to public health guidance may also change a little bit. But I think you really can't detach changes in folks' responses to public health guidance from their response to political messaging. And so I think you really have to imagine on a local and state level entwining those two as we move forward and try to get people to do the right thing.
Scott, I want to change the subject, if I may, with you. I'm curious about what you're finding in terms of testing in the state of Georgia. I mean, there was a period of time, from my point of view, it's been a couple months now since when it was difficult to get an appointment to get a test. Many people were not able to do it. My personal experience has been, and I've had any number of tests at this point, and I haven't had any problem finding a place where I can be tested. But I don't know if I'm representative of the larger population in Georgia. What has your reporting shown on testing in Georgia and how it's ramped up?
Sure. Well, testing is not quite the issue it was at the beginning. At the beginning, of course, we had, contrary to the former president's assertions, if you wanted a test, you could get it. You could not. That was early on in the pandemic. Through the spring, the state built capacity, enlisting the National Guard and Augusta University to ramp up capacity until the private sector and the public health labs in Georgia could take on more of that burden. And then they kind of rolled off, and public health, and private providers have basically been the backbone of our testing infrastructure since then. That said, though, you can get an appointment, you can get tested relatively easily and get results within 2 or 3 days. It's still not enough. We have a test positivity rate, at least of the PCR test, the gold standard test, that's in the double digits right now. I think it was about 13-14% yesterday. You know, that's almost triple what it needs to be. It needs to be more about 5% or even 2% to make sure that we are covering the full landscape of people out there. To capture pre-symptomatic spread, asymptomatic spread. I mean, to Rodney's point, I mean, if you don't know you have the virus, you may be asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic and are going about your day and inadvertently spreading it to people. We don't have a testing infrastructure right now that sort of proactively tests people. People have to choose to make an appointment, and then they go and get a test. And usually they do that when they feel sick or they feel like they've been in an exposure situation. From public health experts I've talked to, you know, we need a broader-based testing strategy than that, some of which is proactive in the sense of I go somewhere, you know, or if I leave my house, I get tested, you know, just sort of as part of my routine, and to capture some of these pre-symptomatic asymptomatic cases before they've had a chance to spread to other people.
I want to ask a very fundamental question. It's one that I have not known the answer to, and I think maybe some of our listeners are curious about it too. Rodney, the PCR test, Scott just described as the gold standard test, as opposed to the rapid response test. I frankly don't, I've never had anything but a rapid test at an urgent care center where I go, and I apparently am taking a test that's less reliable. I don't know the difference. I'm not sure our listeners do, Rodney.
Right. Well, Bill, the rapid test is, you know, just what it says. We refer to this as an antigen test, and it's giving you a result right on the spot. The PCR test is actually taking a specimen. There's, you know, high-tech equipment that's spinning and really examining the contents of that specimen. And the more they spin it, the more sensitive and accurate, you know, well, it becomes in picking up viral particles. So there's an optimal amount of spin that they put on these samples. But, you know, you're right, the PCR test, which can be saliva or can be a nasal swab, is the most reliable. It's the gold standard. And that's what, you know, is recommended. The antigen or rapid test is also a useful tool. One of the things that we, you know, increasingly, you know is that the rapid test is not as accurate. And now we're, there's some potential suggestion that it may not capture some of the new variants of the virus as well as a PCR. So, you know, the PCR is really what you want, though there is often a delay in getting the results, which is the challenge. So, you know, you're balancing speed of result with accuracy. So both have a role.
I would just add to what Rodney said that the antigen test is great if you have symptoms. But if you do not have symptoms, it is much less great. So for asymptomatic testing, the PCR test is really probably the better choice.
All right. In a few minutes, we have to take a break. And after that, I really do want to talk about the vaccine and just what so far seems to have been an abysmal rollout nationally, and Georgia's suffering as well, whether through mistakes being made here or just the problems at a national level, I'll let the panel talk about. But before we move past where the virus stands today, Rodney, one of your areas of expertise at Georgia State is in looking at the challenges of disparities, health disparities in this country. And it just yesterday, the Journal of the American Medical Association published a study which shows us what we basically already knew, but is always also worth emphasizing. And here was the introduction to that study. The disproportionate burden of coronavirus disease on minority populations in the United States is well established. The latest data indicate that age-adjusted mortality rates among Black and Hispanic populations are 3.6 and 2 times higher than for non-Hispanic white populations. This difference translates into almost 30,000 excess deaths among Black and Hispanic residents in the United States, a figure expected to increase substantially in the coming months, even under conservative modeling assumptions. That is a breathtakingly troubling paragraph, Rodney.
Yeah, you know, Bill, let's be clear, race and income matter greatly. We have significant inequities in our society, and those existed before COVID-19, before this pandemic. And what this pandemic has done is really to expose our failures in really addressing these issues and ensuring that people have equal access to resources and opportunities. And, you know, so long as our society is not adequately tackling the challenge of poverty, the challenge of racial inequity, the challenges of structural and racial structural racism, we're going to continue to see these challenges. We need to be sensitive to this as we are, you know, managing our rollout of the vaccine. You mentioned the rates of deaths among African Americans. Those numbers hold for hospitalizations and for cases as well. So those are really troubling, and we certainly have to think about the ways that we are both communicating and providing the resources and access that's needed for those that are on the front lines in terms of essential workers, and placing testing and vaccination sites in communities that are more likely to have a disproportionate impact.
Yeah, and I think it's as much as the virus has had a greater impact on communities of color and especially rural communities of color and rural communities in general, equal concern is the fact that vaccine hesitancy disproportionately affects these communities. And I think going forward, it's going to be really important to devote a lot of resources toward addressing the vaccine hesitancy that we're seeing in these communities, so we can actually try to prioritize them for vaccine and make sure that the uptake of vaccine in those communities helps kind of stanch the tide of cases there. But I know you have to take a break. We can talk about that more in the next part of the show.
Oh, well, thank you for giving me that opening, Karen Landman. We're going to do that. I do want to move on and talk about the vaccine. And in fact, this conversation about the disparities in death rates and cases in minority communities is actually a good lead-in to talking about how the vaccine is being distributed or not being distributed. We'll get to that and a lot more as we continue on today's Political Rewind.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Just to remind you, we're having some technical difficulties, which means that Kevin Riley, unfortunately, we cannot bring him into the program today, which is unfortunate because the AJC has done some outstanding reporting about the virus in Georgia. Fortunately, we are joined by one of the reporters who's been covering the virus for the AJC, Scott Truby. We're also joined by Dr. Rodney Lin of Georgia State University and Dr. Karen Landman, a physician, epidemiologist, and medical journalist. Scott, let's talk a vaccine in the broadest sense right now, because you've been one of the reporters who's been looking at the rollout here of the vaccine in Georgia. Let me just quickly point out that the New York Times is one of the many publications that's been tracking the distribution of the virus so far. And as of, I think this is yesterday, they say that some 16.5 million shots have already been given across the country, and 36 million doses have been distributed. We'll talk, though, more specifically about Georgia. Georgia is on the low end, Scott. Georgia has just given about 400,000 shots as of right now, and only about 3%, a little more than 3% of the population here has gotten a first shot. Scott, how would you characterize, I'll let you put it in your words, the rollout of the vaccine in Georgia, first in terms of numbers of people who are getting it, and second in communication about what you need to do to get the shot?
Yeah. One quick clarification. Georgia Department of Public Health this morning reports that they're at about 535,000 vaccine doses administered. So there is, it's a little bit better than what the New York Times has this morning, but obviously Georgia's in the near the bottom of getting doses into arms. The bottom line is, I mean, we're measured, as all states are measured, by per capita distribution, and we're not doing as well as other states. Part of that is we don't have a great public health infrastructure in local communities and counties. They're strapped right now. They're doing testing. They're doing other diseases. They're doing now vaccine distribution. That's part of the problem. We also know that, you know, we're kind of undercounting how many doses we've given because we have an antiquated reporting technology called GRITS through the state of Georgia, which has been providers have had a devil of a time reporting their numbers. So that's kind of setting us back a little bit, too, in terms of what is actually appearing and reporting nationally. But the bottom line is we're just not getting enough shots into arms. I do think we can do a lot better, but it's going to take more resources and it's going to take more money. And the governor's going to have a press conference later on this afternoon. Hopefully we'll learn a little bit more about what their plans are.
Rodney, let me turn to you and then Karen on this. Just yesterday, the AJC had a story talking about at least one individual who was given an appointment to get a shot in one of the locations, one of the county public health facilities that were offering shots. He showed up. He was told, no, there's not vaccine. He's told he's not on the list. I had a strange situation in which I was able to get my first shot by a fluke. I'm old enough that I fall into the category where people can get shots. But, Rodney, there's confusion here. People are desperate. People who are over 65, people who are frontline workers, they're scrambling to figure out where to go to get vaccinated, and it's become like vaccine roulette, Rodney.
Yeah, it's a mess, Bill. I'm not sure there's another way to characterize it. Let's sort of think about this from an infrastructure standpoint and from a system standpoint. We have in the state of Georgia the second greatest number of counties of any state in the country, only behind Texas. So we've got 159 health departments. I think we have over 1,000 sites that are distributing vaccine. And so it's a large distribution network. But the problem is that we have clinicians and public health professionals having been working on testing, a medical response, data and reporting, and now they're being asked to stand up vaccinations. And from a federal standpoint, a start would be to assess the assets and resources that are available to quickly distribute the vaccine. So the federal government should be working with states to assess that across the states and really to use the assets that are available and the places where there's capacity to roll out lots of vaccine quickly to really resource those and make sure that happens. What we have right now is a mass distribution of vaccine to a large network of providers and sites that have greatly varying capacity to actually schedule people, administer the vaccine, report what's happened. And so it's a real mess at the moment, which was my initial point. So, you know, it's never too late for leadership and planning and assessing what the assets and resources are and creating a distribution plan that leverages those assets and resources. So that would be my suggestion, is that we not continue to just hope things get better, that we really rely on federal and state leadership to make sure that happens. It is a bit of a challenge if you're out there trying to figure out where to get a vaccine and how to schedule. If you go to a pharmacy, the phone's not working, you got to show up in person, put yourself on a list. The health departments are overscheduled. There are lots of real challenges. And so there's a need for leadership here. And the federal government and the states are really going to have to do that and not expect the localities to handle all of this.
Karen, let me ask you to weigh in on this, but let me add a layer to this. It strikes me that there are kind of two different issues here. One of the issues is simply whether any state, well, let's look at Georgia specifically, because some states are getting more supplies than others. Georgia would argue, Governor Kemp has argued, they're simply not getting enough doses from the federal government. So that's one issue, how you deal with the supply of vaccine coming into the state. But the other is a communication issue. How clearly or not clearly public health departments are informing Georgians about the procedures under which they can get vaccinated, what the problems they might face are. So it strikes me there's a communication problem at the state level as well as a supply problem, too. But you know more about this than I do, Karen.
So first to the supply problem, I think there's no doubt that, first of all, the Fed controls the supply. That is not up to Georgia. But you know, even if you account for some undercounting by the federal government of the number of doses that Georgians are actually getting in their arms, there's still about 20%, I believe, according to some folks' math, 20% of the vaccine that Georgia has that still is not going into arms right now. And I think, you know, that really is a product of, like you said, the communication piece. Understand that this has been a problem dumped on the health district, health departments in Georgia. So the state department, state health department has basically had to give the responsibility for setting up an entire mass vaccine distribution system to these districts who have not been given additional manpower or additional resources to set up these facilities, to set up websites. You know, they don't have the capacity to do this on their own, but they are nevertheless having to do it. So it's an enormous lift. I would take some hope from the part of the national strategy that recommends deploying the National Guard and potentially a public health service corps out to these districts, not just in Georgia, of course, but nationally, to help support local health departments in doing this work, but asking them to do it without any additional support. And you'll note that Toomey, in her testimony before the Joint Appropriations hearing the other day at the Georgia legislature, didn't ask for an increase in the health department's budget. So there's no additional funds even being asked for in the future to do this. So it's really an enormous ask to be able to do this all by themselves.
Scott, I don't know that it was your byline on this particular piece, but not long ago, I was struck by a couple of sentences in an AJC article about vaccine distribution in the state. Quoting a state public health official, the comment was, and this was just a couple weeks ago, we're thinking about setting up drive-through locations where people can be vaccinated. Now, this probably didn't come. This quote was not much longer ago than the beginning of this year. We have known, as the federal government has, for 6 months that a vaccine was likely to be approved and manufactured and ready for distribution by the end of the year. And to read at the beginning of 2021 that a state public health agency is now thinking about how they should be setting up drive-through facilities strikes me as so troubling, it's hard to even describe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we do have, through the testing, you know, infrastructure, drive-through settings that I think county departments are starting to transition to either vaccine-only or jointly vaccine and testing sites. But no, you're right. I mean, we have limited resources. That is true. And to Karen's point, we're not adding money, apparently, to the Georgia public health budget, though maybe money will come from the federal government soon. We could have had a more creative rollout to jointly handle testing and vaccine. We could have surged with the National Guard. There are other avenues that could have been done, and they weren't. And in some areas, you just had very sparse public health infrastructure, particularly in rural areas, that you know, they had to decide, do I test or do I vaccinate? And they decided to vaccinate. And I sympathize with those departments because they did not have another choice.
And I would, thank you. I would also say, you know, we're talking about this as though the sole purpose of local and district health departments is to do COVID work, to do the testing and vaccine work. In reality, they do so many other things. Not only do they do, you know, respond to local public health issues, but they do a huge amount of administration of WIC, the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program. They do a lot of HIV testing and treatment, TB testing and treatment, STD testing and treatment. All of these things, you know, they're trying, many are trying to maintain these activities, but they're all falling by the wayside as people are being marshaled into this this effort to deploy vaccine and testing at the same time. But again, they do not have the manpower and resources to do.
Yeah. One thing I was struck by is, you know, I think it was Fulton County. I mean, they got a few hours notice that they were going to be expanding, you know, testing to include more people, and then suddenly had to, you know, set up an appointment scheduling apparatus and testing and vaccination sites. So, you know, it's been a mess of a rollout, and you know, one thing we haven't seen. I mean, yes, the governor has done press conferences with Dr. Toomey, and they've gotten the messages out there, but there's not been an overarching public health messaging campaign that's on billboards and in television advertising and web advertising and Facebook. There just hasn't been a devoted effort to that would help clear up some of these issues, whether it goes back to testing or now into vaccination.
Yeah, I just want to, you know, emphasize or add weight to what Karen and Scott are saying here. What we're really doing is asking the people in the trenches, the people on the front line, who are doing the hard work every day, taking the fire as it were, those cannot be the same people that are developing the overall battle plan. It just, that's not going to work. There's not the capacity to be on the front line and thinking about the larger system of distribution. As I said before, there's got to be an assessment of the assets and the resources and then the infusion of the support to stand up the sites and roll this up much quicker than it's happening, and to communicate with the public, you know, much more effectively about where to go, when, who's eligible, that kind of information. So we've got a long way to go here.
I've got to get to a break, but I want to thank all three of you for pulling me back, I think, from the cliff a little bit here. I think I sound kind of awfully critical about how the county public health departments are handling all this, and maybe to some extent for some good reason. But I thank you for reminding me that they have a lot to do. That there is not, number one, until Biden rolls out his plan, a coordinated federal response that gets more money out to states to be able to pay for these, for vaccinations and other aspects of COVID work. We have not so far seen a coordinated, I don't think, a state ability to get everybody on the same page. So thank you for reminding me that this is a much more complicated problem, but I do think I represent sort of a feeling of frustration that a lot of the people in our listening audience have right now, and maybe this is helpful to them to take a deeper breath and see what happens next. All right, we got to get to a break. We'll be right back with more on Political Rewind. We'll get back to our conversation about the state of the virus, vaccines, testing here in the state of Georgia in just a minute. But, you know, before we do, I've been talking on the show for more than a week now about how in these difficult times, the notion of finding in each of our lives some small comforts that give us a little bit of joy, give us some relief from the gloom that has been surrounding us in the pandemic, in our politics. And we've encouraged you to send us the small comforts that you are turning to. And
I always run out of time at every show to be able to share any of what you sent me. So before we finish up talking about COVID, at least today I want to read you one small comfort that I got as an email, and you can email me. Just my email address is BNIGUTGPB. You can also call us and leave a voicemail at 404-685-2426. Tell us your name and where you're calling from. But here's just one of them. Carol Schneier said, I thought this was great. My small comforts come from home improvement projects while listening to Political Rewind and other radio news. During the late summer, it was the RBG floor laying quarry tiles in my great room during Ruth Bader Ginsburg's, funeral arrangements and about the replacement for her on the Supreme Court. During the fall, it was election timber, cutting up downed trees from Tropical Storm Etta and pulling privet in my yard. And during December, she said it was the runoff wall bin, building a small cupboard to hold gloves, hats, and a scarf. So we thank you, Carol, and I'd love to hear from more of you. Okay, back to the panel. Karen, now one of the concerns of people who've had a first shot is they're suddenly desperate because there's no way they think they're going to be able to schedule an appointment for a second. So a couple of questions, medically oriented questions about that, because we don't know what's going to happen to supply in the weeks ahead. Once you've had, I think I'm right, the Pfizer vaccine, the first shot, 21 days later, you need the booster. Moderna, it's a 28-day period. Without regard to whether the they're going to get their supply, can you are they talking about mixing and matching? If people don't get the second shot within a reasonable period of time, are they not going to be protected? I mean, Karen, there are lots of medical problems that I think we haven't had enough time to study and get data on, have we?
Yeah, I have not heard anybody endorse mixing and matching. But honestly, I'm perhaps not as up to date on that piece of the conversation as I could be. I think, you know, it certainly has not been tested. So I think any mixing and matching would really be an experiment in vivo, which is not what we really want to be doing right now. I am hoping that under the new federal plan that there will be a great ramp up in production using perhaps I forget the exact name of it, the Defense Production Act, that we will be able to pour new resources into ramping up the amount of vaccine that becomes available to states so that people can get their second vaccine of the same brand as the original vaccine they got. There was good coverage yesterday in the AJC of concerns about getting a second appointment, that a lot of people were not made a second appointment after their first appointment. And people do need to get that second dose in order to have really a protective immunity from the vaccine. For it to really work, you need that second dose. Johnson & Johnson hopefully will be rolling out some data that proves their vaccine. It has high efficacy in the next few weeks. And that would mean that a single dose vaccine would be available on the market a few weeks after that, as soon as FDA approves it. So, you know, I think there's hope that this will be simplified in the future. But for now, I would say get a second dose of the same vaccine that you got a first dose of for full protection.
Yeah, I think Karen is right. And I would, you know, just add here that, you know, with a second dose, we're looking at 90% to 95%, you know, effectiveness. If there's no second dose, for instance, the Pfizer vaccine is roughly about 50% effective. So, you know, that's still significant. We want people to get a second dose, get it when they are supposed to get it. But there's going to be some protective effect, even if that doesn't happen. I want to be clear that we should do everything to make sure people are getting their second dose in a timely way. I also just want to quickly say, Bill, because I think some of your listeners may want to really know, where do I get vaccinated? Who's eligible? That sort of thing. So I think I just want to share a couple of things that I use as resources. The website dph.ga.gov, which is the State Department of Public Health. There are two things on there that I look at very regularly. One is the vaccine locator. That's a resource. But the other thing is the vaccine orders list, which lists every site in the state that has vaccine. It tells you which vaccines they have and how much they have. And I believe this is updated every Monday. So that's a good place if you want to really look at in your county or the area you live where there is vaccine. How to schedule is going to vary from place to place. So you just have to sort of, be persistent, make phone calls, go to websites, and so on. And, hopefully the system improves, but that's where we are right now. I think that will be a good resource for listeners.
I am really grateful to you for sharing that. Sam and Amelia, I know, will be more than happy to post a link to the State Department of Public Health's website to be able to keep track of all that. Scott, you mentioned that the governor's holding a news conference later on this afternoon. Reporters don't like to tip their hand about what questions they're going to ask elected officials, but what are the most pressing questions you imagine reporters, in terms of the COVID crisis, should be asking the governor this afternoon?
Have you heard of, what the allotment is going to be of vaccine in any updates from the federal government from the new Biden administration? I know they're still wrapping their arms around operating government, but before the Trump administration moved on, they talked about releasing the reserve, and it turned out there wasn't a reserve. So what is our allotment going to be? Dr. Toomey said earlier this week that they really don't have a clear sense week to week how many doses that Georgia is going to get. That's a big problem. We need to be asking that of our state leaders. Our state leaders need to be holding the federal government accountable as well. So that's one big thing. What are we going to be doing to have a more centralized or more coherent scheduling system, and what are we doing to broaden distribution? I mean, those are some of the questions I think that my colleagues who will be at the press conference, I actually won't be there today, but my colleagues at the paper and other news organizations, I think those are going to be some of the questions they'll want answered by Governor Kemp and Dr. Toomey.
On a national basis, of course, throughout the day today, we will all be watching, all of us in the journalistic community, obviously, to see the rollout of the Biden COVID strategy, the 21 points, I think it's somewhere in that neighborhood, what he wants to do to nationalize this effort to get money to the states, more vaccine produced and out to the states, testing. It's going to be really a fascinating thing to watch what happens there. We're completely out of time. Scott Truby, Rodney Lynn, Karen Landman, thank you for a great conversation today. We'll be back again tomorrow. In the meantime, I'm Bill Nygut. Take care, stay healthy, and yes, keep wearing your mask. See you tomorrow.